Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's just the tutorials.
Yeah, I'm just, yes, so that'd be the two announcements where you can point her out. I mean, she seems a very conscientious professor, which is good. Yeah, I mean, I haven't had one like send out a nasty note before, which is fine. Let's go.
I did.
Yeah. Okay. Well.
So.
Well. Yeah. Okay. Whatever. Doesn't matter. Yeah. Yeah. It can't do any harm.
Yeah.
Yes. Tutorials and labs. Because it sounds like a few people didn't sign up for both.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But.
So a couple of announcements. First of all, the course rep, could you stand up, please? So if you don't know who the course rep is, that is the course rep. All right. Second announcement. There's still about 10 of you who haven't signed up for the tutorials and labs. Please do it. If you don't do it, we are going to close the polls, and you're not going to be in any tutorial group. By the way, we said this before. The labs are really quite useful for doing the coursework assignment in the end, and the tutorials are pretty essential for passing the exam. There is really, if you can do one thing that will contribute the most to you passing the exam is the tutorials. So please sign up. Okay, so. Last time we were talking about the naive Bayes classifier, right? So, just to remind you, so it's a very simple probabilistic classifier. You're trying to compute the probability of the class Y given the representation X of the data, and you do it through Bayes' rule. And there are three components in the classifier. So there is the prior that tells you a priori how likely a certain class is. So you know. Does the patient have a common cold or avian flu? One of those classes is a lot more likely than the other. And naive Bayes encodes that explicitly in the classifier. The second main component is the class model. So that tells you if they have an avian flu, do the symptoms look plausible? Right. That's the point of the class model. And we talked about the normalizer. That what makes the probabilities sort of puts the probabilities on the same scale, regardless of what your observation is. So what are we going to do today is we're going to walk through a continuous example for naive Bayes. a discrete example and also talk about some advantages of naive Bayes as a method. So, a continuous example. We started doing it in the last lecture. So suppose I have a population of individuals, and for each individual, I measure their height and weight. And what I want to do is I want to build a classifier, a naive Bayes classifier, that's going to separate adult individuals from child individuals, right? So my training data is going to look as triples, height, weight, class, right? So the height is just the height in centimeters, the weight is the weight in kilos, and the class, Y, this is either A or C, adult or child. So if I have 4 adults and 12 children, that tells me the prior already. I know that a priori, you're 3 times more likely to be a child than you're an adult, at least in this population that I'm modeling, right? And then what I need to do is I need to construct a model of what an adult looks like. What think of it, what does an average adult look like? That's what this is doing. And the way I'm doing this is I'm going to take the height and I'm going to construct a Gaussian distribution that tells me what the heights of adults look like. And Gaussian has 2 parameters. It has the mean and the variance. And estimating them is really easy because I have the training data. I have my 4 instances of adults. So to compute the mean height, the average height of an adult, I just look at all of the heights for individuals who are adults and add them up and divide by 4, right? So that gives me the average height of an adult. And I also need the variance for the Gaussian. That tells me how sort of how much the heights vary among adults. And the variance, you compute that just by, again, going over all the adult individuals in your data and subtracting the mean height, the average height, from the height of each individual, squaring the difference, and then adding it up. That gives you the variance, right? So this, these 2 numbers together, the mean and the variance, they describe what an average adult height should look like, right? Then I do the same thing, the same exact thing for the weight of the average adult. And then I need to do the same thing for the children. So I will go to measure that average height. I will go over every child in my data, add up their heights, and divide by the total, right? And do the variance in the same way, and then do the weight of the children in the same manner. So that is going to give me 4 total Gaussians. I'll have 2 Gaussians for an adult, the height and the weight, and 2 Gaussians for the children, the height and the weight. And we're assuming it's a naive Bayes classifier. This means that we're assuming that the height and the weight are independent of each other. So when I need to compute the probability for the instance, I compute the probability for the height, probability for the weight, and multiply them together. So what does it look like graphically? Now, suppose that this is my data set. I have 16 individuals. 4 of them are adults, 12 of them are children. So adults are red dots, children are black dots. I have the height and the weight, and all of them fall in some spaces in this plane. So what does it look like when I'm doing the estimation? So those are my priors. Now, to what happens when I'm estimating a Gaussian, what was on the previous slide. Let's do the height of the children first. So effectively, I'm taking all of these points and I'm projecting them to this height axis, right? And if I do that, you just get a bunch of points. So these are the heights of children, independent of the weight. And then from here, I'm computing the mean and the variance. And they together determine the Gaussian. So this Gaussian, this tells me how the heights of children are distributed. And if you look at it, you actually see that, well, this isn't exactly what a Gaussian would look like, but I am doing naive Bayes with a Gaussian. So I'm assuming that it has to follow the Gaussian distribution. So this is what the heights should look like. Now I do the same thing for the weights. I look at the weights in isolation, independently of the height. And this gives me a Gaussian for the weights. Now, we are doing naive Bayes. The height and the weight are independent. So in order to get the overall Gaussian, to look at what this Gaussian looks like in the 2D space, all I'm doing is I'm taking this Gaussian and multiplying it by that Gaussian. The result is going to be a bump. So I think on the previous lecture, Charles showed you these what these Gaussian bumps look like. So we know that this bump has to be axis aligned, so it can't be turned because they're independent. This is the only thing that you can get if you multiply one Gaussian by another Gaussian. If you look at it from the top, you'll see sort of these are the iso lines, these are the contour lines of this Gaussian. So this set of ellipses, this is my model of what a child looks like in terms of the height and the weight. Now, once I've done it for the children, I'm going to do the same thing for adults, and the process is exactly the same. I'm estimating the height Gaussian, the weight Gaussian, multiplying them together, and that gives me a red bump that tells me this is my model of adults. Now, how do I use this? We're building a classifier. The purpose of the classifier is you get a new data point, X, and you have to tell me, the classifier has to tell me whether it's more likely to be a child or an adult. Right? So, how does the classifier do that? Basically, what the classifier is going to do, it's going to compute the probability of this observation of this red dot coming from the child model. It's going to compute the probability of it coming from the adult model, and then use Bayes rule to compute the posterior probability of this being a child or an adult. Right. Simple enough. So what does it look like in terms of formulas? So this is an equation of a Gaussian. This is a Gaussian that represents the height of children. So I have the mean height of a child, mu, and the standard and the variance of the child's height, sigma squared, hc. Right. So I'm taking the child, the height of the observation x, subtracting the mean height of a child, dividing by the variance, and then putting it through a Gaussian. Right. This gives me the probability that a child would have this height. Right. And looking at it graphically, is this going to be a big number or a small number? Who thinks it's small? Okay, who thinks it's big? You're all wrong. So the height of this point, the height is right next to the mean. It's going to be a big number, right? So the height of this individual is exactly at the mean of the Gaussian. So you expect it to be as big as it gets, right? Now, if the height was over there or over there, you'd expect it to be a small number, but it's right on the mean, okay? So the height of this point really looks like a child. Now, I do the same thing for the weight. And it's the same formula, the only difference is I'm plugging the mean and the variance of the weight Gaussian, right? And this gives me the probability that a child would have this weight. And is this a big number or a small number? Small number, okay, good. So this child has an unusually, this, you know, if this instance were a child, it would have an unusually high weight for children. That's what it tells you. Right. So it has a normal-looking height, but the weight is unlikely for a child. Now you do the same thing for adult. So now you look at the red Gaussian and you say, well, what is the probability of seeing such a height, given that it's an adult, and what is the probability of seeing such a weight if it's an adult? And can you tell me which one is going to be bigger, the probability of the height from the adult model or the weight? The weight, okay, good, so we're on the same page. The weight of this individual looks like a typical adult, but the height is a little bit small, right? So, now once you've computed these numbers, you have to combine them together, and this is where the independence assumption comes into play. I want to compute overall, you know, not just height or weight individually, overall, how probable is this height and weight? How probable is this individual under the adult model? And the way I do that is I multiply together the probabilities for the height and the weight that I computed above there, right? And then I'm going to do the same thing for the child. So what these numbers tell me, what this tells me is, assuming this is a child, what is the probability of seeing such a height and weight? Or assuming this is an adult, what are the odds of seeing such a height and weight? Right. And now once I computed these, I can use Bayes' rule to convert them into the posterior probability. This is what I want. What I want is not assuming that it's a child, how probable it is. What I want is, given what I see, what is the probability that it's a child? Right. And you get exactly that from Bayes' rule. Given what I see, x, the height and the weight, what is the probability that it's an adult? And the Bayes' rule tells me how to do that. I look at the probability of the observation given the adult model times the prior of an adult model, so that's your 4 over 16, divided by the normalizer. And the normalizer in this case is composed just of the two components. So it's the prior of an adult times the class conditional plus the prior of a child times the class conditional. Okay. So this is how you compute the probability of this is how you do a prediction. So once I have this, how do I decide if it's a child or an adult? How can I? Yeah, it's a probability. So basically I could say, well, you know, is this bigger than 50%, right? If it's bigger than 50%, then it's probably an adult, or at least it's more likely to be an adult than it is to be a child. Or I could put a threshold in there. I could say, well, you know, unless it's 80%, I'm not going to claim it's either an adult or a child. Either way, so you can do something like that. Okay, so that's a continuous. That's an example of a continuous Gaussian. And right now, we should also look at the at what the problems are with naive Bayes. So it's actually a pretty neat classifier, but it's got this pretty funny property. So now suppose that this is another case where I have a population of children, black dots, and population of adult, red dots. Now, they're different populations, clearly. Now, suppose I try to estimate the naive Bayes classifier as before, right? So I'm gonna estimate the child model first, and how do I do that? I take all the points, I look at their, you know, say this is height, I project them down, and this gives me some sort of a Gaussian. Right, and then I do the same thing for the weight, and then I multiply them together. That's going to give me some sort of a bump, a Gaussian bump over this space. Now, suppose I do the same thing for adults. Right, so I project all of the red points down to this axis, and I estimate a Gaussian, and I end up with the same Gaussian as for the children. Right, and I end up with the same Gaussian for the weight as for the children. So what's happening here is when you look at the height and the weight independently, in isolation, there is no difference in height by itself. There is no difference in weight by itself. So the models that you get for the two classes would be identical. So naive Bayes cannot distinguish between these two populations. So, you know, you look at them and you say, well, but look, you know, one of them has a positive correlation, another one has a negative correlation. And what does naive Bayes say? Naive Bayes says, what's a correlation? It doesn't do correlations. It assumes independence, right? And if you look at them independently, there is no difference. All of the difference between this adult population and this child population is in the correlation. The marginals, so these things are the marginals, they're identical. So naive Bayes cannot handle something like that, no matter how much you try, right? So that's a major downside of the classifier. Now look, let's look at another example. So that was the continuous example. Let's look at the discrete case. Suppose you have, suppose you're trying to classify emails as to whether they are ham or spam. And I'm going to assume that my attributes are words. So if you think back to the second lecture, we talked about how you could possibly represent text. And one way to represent text is a bag of words. So for each word, you notice whether the word was absent or present in a particular instance. Okay. So I have 6 emails. 2 of them are ham, 4 of them are spam. So how does a naive Bayes classifier look in this, what does it look like in this case? So the first thing I always do is compute the priors, right? The priors, this tells you a priori, before you say any words, how likely is it that something is ham or spam. And in this case, I have four spam messages, so the prior probability of spam is 4/6 and ham is 2/6. Now, the next thing I do is I have to start counting. And it's a naive Bayes classifier, so that makes things easy. This means I can count each attribute individually, independently of all the other ones. So that's what I'm doing. So I'm taking each word that occurs in any of these emails, and I'm counting how many times I see it among the spam emails and among the ham emails. So the word password, I see it twice in the spam, right there and right there. And I also see it in one ham email, right there, right? So these are my counts. Password occurs in 2 out of 4 spam emails and in 1 out of 2 ham emails. And I do the same thing for every word. For every word in my vocabulary, I count how many times I see it in the spam emails, how many times I see it in the ham emails. One thing you want to notice is so I have positive counts for all the words except a count. A count happens only once, and it happens to be in a spam email. So what does that mean? That means that if I just follow this procedure, I'm going to have a 0 out of 2 chances of seeing a count in a ham email. So what does it mean? This means that if this is my estimate, this means that I never expect to see a word account in a ham email. That's a pretty strong assumption, and we're going to see how it's going to bite us later on. But for now, just this is the procedure that you take, right? So this tells me the distribution, how often I expect to see a particular word either in ham or in the spam. So then I get a new email, right? Now what I want to do is I want to figure out if this email is ham or spam. How do I do this? The first thing I do is I have to represent that email in the same way as I represented the rest of my data, right? And I'm representing it as a bag of words. So in this case, well, okay, I guess I missed one thing. So the new email is review us now. Now is the word that I've never seen before, right? So I haven't seen it in the ham emails. I haven't seen it in the spam emails. In fact, I've never seen it at all. So the convenience of a naive Bayes classifier is that if something like that happens, well, you just throw it away, right? So you pretend that the word didn't happen there. And actually, most of the other classifiers we're going to do, they're going to assume the same thing. So if you see a feature, if you see a word that you've never seen before, you just throw it away. So in fact, this email gets reduced to just review us. So that's what we're going to be dealing with. Now, in terms of the representation, in terms of the attribute value pairs, this email turns into the following bit string, right? So what does it mean? This is my vocabulary, password review, send us your account. And I'm assuming that password is going to correspond to the first bit, review to the second bit, and so on. So why is it 010100, right? This email, review us, it doesn't have the word password, so it's a 0. It does have the word review, so it's a 1. It doesn't have the word send, so it's a 0. It does have the word us, and so on. So when you're doing this, it is important to include both zeros and ones. It's a common mistake to just focus on the ones when you're doing a set. You have to do all of them. So this is the representation of the email. And now what I need to compute is I need to compute what is the probability of seeing this representation in the spam class. And I can compute that from this table and from one little assumption, the assumption of independence, that tells me that all the bits here are independent. So I have the 0 bit. That means that the word password doesn't occur in this email. What I want to compute now is what is the probability that the word password doesn't occur in the spam email? And that's pretty simple. I know that 2 out of 4 spam emails contain the word password. That means that 2 out of 4 don't contain the word password. So the probability of not seeing the word password in a spam email is 1 - 2/4 from the table. Okay. Now, the next word, the word review, it occurs in an email. So I want to get the probability that the word review occurs in a spam email. And I just read it off the table, right? It's 1/4. The next word, us, doesn't occur in the email, so I take 1 - 3/4. 3/4 is the probability that a spam email contains the word us. And this is just, the send. And this is the probability that it doesn't contain. Right. So I multiply all of those numbers together, all the way to the end. And if you're looking for patterns and symmetries, so as many ones as you have, you're just going to take the numbers from the table, right? So the 1/4 here and the 3/4 here, right? Everything else is going to be 1 - the number from the table. So anytime I have a 0, I take 1 - the number from the table. So this is assuming that this email is spam, how plausible it is that I will see the words in that email, review us. I can do the same thing for the ham, and the pattern is the same. It's the same bit representation, but now I'm going to be using different probabilities from the table. Now I'm going to be using the second column of that table. So it doesn't contain the word password, so I know that 1 out of 2, one out of two ham emails contain it, 1 out of 2 don't, so I take 1 - 1/2 as the probability that ham email doesn't contain the word password. And then I do the same thing for every word in the vocabulary. Right. So I put it together. Now the next thing, once I've got these two numbers, and so the first one, the first one comes out to 0044, the second one comes out to 0.0625. I'm not done yet. What I need to do is I need to take these numbers and plug them into Bayes' rule. Right? And for doing that, I'm going to need the priors, the 4/6 and the 2/6. So I take the probability of seeing the words, given that it's ham, multiplied by the prior of the email being ham, and divide by the total. And as a result, I get 0.87. So is this, you know, would naive Bayes classify it as ham or spam? Ham. And it's pretty confident about that too, right? 87%. That's what it says, the confidence, the probability is. And this is actually a little bit embarrassing, and this is embarrassing because if you look at it, this email, review us, well, you did have it as an example in your training data, and it was actually a spam email, right? So, but that's how Naive Bayes works. Naive Bayes doesn't look at individual examples of what you've seen before. We're going to look at a classifier that does that. That's the Naive Bayes classifier. Oh, sorry, the K-nearest neighbor classifier. Gosh. But Naive Bayes doesn't work like that. It doesn't look at individual examples. It just counts for each word independently. How many times have you seen it in spam? How many times have you seen it in ham? And then combines them all together. And if you do that, well, you get this. So you would actually classify an identical email as ham, even though you had an example of it being spam. Okay. So this is how it works. Now, what are the downsides? What are the problems with Naive Bayes? One is the zero frequency problem that we mentioned. So if you look here, the word account, it only occurred in spam emails. Right, so the probability of seeing account in a ham email is zero. And zeros are special in the sense that as soon as you have 1 0 in a product, the whole product turns into zero, right? So what this means is that any email that has the word account, any email whatsoever, will be classified as spam right there and then. This is probably not something that you want. So what you want to do is you want to change the estimates. Instead of just counting how many times you see the word or don't see the word, You could do something that, so this is called smoothing or shrinkage sometimes. So instead of just counting the numbers, you add a little epsilon to all the counts, right? So this would be the number of, say this is the number of ham emails that contained the word account. So this number is zero, but instead of putting a zero in the estimate of the probability, I'm going to add a little epsilon to it, right? And on the bottom, I have the total number of ham emails, so I have to make sure that things add up properly. So one way to do it is to sort of add a little, add two epsilon in there. So this makes sure that you never ever have zeros. So if you have a word, yeah. Why it's 2 times epsilon? Because I'm assuming that you're adding the epsilon to the positive count and to the negative count as well. That's kind of counterintuitive, yeah. If you don't add it to the negative counts, then you wouldn't have a 2 in there. Then you just have an epsilon. I'm sorry? So, actually, here's... Something like this is another problem. So when the word doesn't occur, you have a zero, right? But this is problematic as well. The word review always occurs in ham emails. So if you have an email that doesn't contain the word review, its probability under the ham class is going to be zero. Because the probability of a ham email not containing review is 1 minus 2 over 2, which is 0, right? So that's another problem. What I'm assuming here is that you're adding an epsilon both for sort of existent counts and non-existent counts. Okay. So an epsilon is very crude. This is, I guess, in the language modeling literature, they call it Laplace correction. Something that works much better a lot of the time is, instead of using an epsilon, you could look at how frequent the word is in the data set as a whole. So instead of an epsilon, you take how many emails contained that word versus the total number of emails, regardless of the class. So this is a good thing to do sometimes. You may be tempted to think that this is a marginal problem. So, you know, how many times am I going to see that the word has no counts? It seems like this wouldn't occur all that much. If you are taking text technologies, you know that this will actually occur a lot more often than you expect. So there is a law called Zipf's law. That describes the occurrence properties of words in text. And this law says that in any collection of documents, half of all the words are only going to occur once. That means that if you happen to remove that instance where the word occurred, you would have a zero frequency right there and then. So this problem is very common. It happens all the time. So any implementation of naive Bayes that looks at words has to implement some sort of a smoothing strategy. So it's not a marginal case. It's sort of bread and butter. You have to do it. So the second downside of naive Bayes is it does assume word independence. This means that each word contributes individually to the probabilities. So one way you could trick naive Bayes, if you were a sneaky spammer, is you could stuff your spam emails with lots of hammy words, right? Because those words contribute independently, they would actually skew the probabilities towards ham rather than spam. So even if your email is advertising excellent investment opportunities, as long as you add some as long as you add a lot of hammy words to the end, this will fool the naive Bayes classifier. So now let's look at two examples where naive Bayes is actually quite nice. So there are two interesting issues that machine learning methods have to deal with. So one is dealing with missing data. So that's when you don't have a particular observation in an instance. And another one is sort of incremental updates. And naive Bayes is particularly nice in both regards. So missing data, what is this all about? So this is a case where you need to classify some training example, but one of the attributes is missing. So missing not in the sense like a word missing from an email. When a word is missing from the email, it's not actually missing. It's not present, right? It's a zero in the binary representation. So what I mean by missing is usually defined in terms of either categorical or numeric attributes. That's where you really should have a value in there, but for some reason you don't. So perhaps you're trying to decide whether to lend money to an applicant, and you have his entire profile, but there's no mention of a credit history. It should be there, but it's not there. So maybe somebody forgot to ask a question, or maybe some data got lost in the transmission. Something happened. You just don't have that. Or if you are trying to diagnose somebody, maybe some test just wasn't run on that person, right? So it didn't come back positive. It didn't come back negative. It just didn't happen at all. So how do you deal with that? It's actually a problem for many of the classifiers that we'll discuss in this course. It's not a problem for naive Bayes, and we'll talk about why. So what this means you have to do is, when you are in terms of naive Bayes, when you're computing the class model, when you're computing the probability of an observation given a class, you have an unknown variable, right? So maybe you have D different attributes, the class Y, right? So for the first attribute, you know you should look at the probability of little x1 given Y. You should look at the probability of little xd given Y. But xj, if the value is missing, what should you take? What probability should you look at? And the answer is surprisingly simple. In the naive Bayes classifier, if some attribute is missing, you can just ignore it. You can pretend that it's not there. That's beautiful. That's just about as easy as it gets. Right? So what does it mean? That means that if I'm computing this probability, this joint probability turns into a product of probabilities. And if some value is missing, it means that I don't have to include that term in the product. Right? So normally, this product would go from I equals 1 to D. Right? And now I'm saying go from I equals 1 to D, but omit the jth component. Don't compute any probability for it, right? So it's a lot easier than what we'll have to do for other classifiers, where we actually have to try to fill in the missing values. Now, why can we do that? Why is this sensible? And to see why it's sensible, we need just a little bit of algebra, right? So let's take a toy example. So suppose I toss a coin three times, right? So the first outcome is heads, the last outcome is tails, and the second outcome, I don't tell you what it is, right? So this is a missing value. This is somebody didn't run a test, or somebody forgot to flip a coin the second time, right? So what this event means, it's sort of in terms of a formal representation, it's you got a head on the first observation, you got a tail on the last one, but you really don't know what happened on the second. Now, you don't know what happened on the second, but you know that there are really only two possibilities. It could have been a head, or it could have been a tail. Right. So, overall, if I don't know whether it was a head or a tail, one way to represent that in terms of sets is as a union of two possibilities, right? So if it was a head, then my event would be HHT, head, head, tail. If it was a tail, then the event would be head, HTT, head, tail, tail. And the event of not knowing is the union of these two events, right? They overlap on the first, they overlap on the second, but in the middle, you're not sure. So that's sort of a graphical representation of it. You have a head on the first, you have a tail on the third, but on the second one, you're not sure. So these two events are disjoint events. So in order to compute the probability for the entire event, you can just add together the probability for the individual components. Right? So the probability of this whole event, of the second toss being unknown, is the probability of HHT plus the probability of HTT. Okay, so this is trivial. This should be obvious. Now, how does this help us with the naive Bayes classifier? And in the naive Bayes classifier, we're looking at a slightly more general case. We're assuming that that jth coordinate is not present. Now, so what does it mean? Normally, if all of the data was known, you would be computing the joint probability of an observation by breaking it down into little numbers and multiplying them all together, right? So the probability of x1 given y, the probability of x2 given y, all the way down to xd, right, and xj. And here's our xj. Now, in the missing data case, we don't actually know xj, right? So, but we can use this trick to compute the probability of the missing data. So what is this trick? What I have to do is I have to add up the probabilities of all the possible events that have x1 and x2 and xd, but have different possible values of xj. Right? So that's what I'm doing here. This is a summation that goes over possible values of xj. So if xj is binary, if it's either, you know, the test came out positive or negative, then there's two possibilities here. So the sum is going to consist of just two terms. But it's a general equation that works for as many terms as you may want to have. Right. So this is what we want. We want to take this probability, this joint probability of the observations given a class, and add it up over all possible values of xj. Right. Now we know one more thing. So this is just the basic probability axioms. We also know that we are assuming independence. When we're assuming independence, we can factor out the joint into the product of the marginal conditionals. So this summation, under the sum, what you have is a product of these individual guys. Right. So the product for x1 given y, x2 given y, xd given y, and also xj. And you're summing up over all possible values of xj. Now, why is this helpful? This is helpful because you realize that x1, this term, actually has nothing to do with xj. So what can I do algebraically? I can move it out of the summation, right? And I can do the same thing for x2. And in fact, I can do the same thing for all of them, for xd. The only thing that I can't move out of the summation is xj itself, because, you know, this, it is xj. That's what the summation is over. So if I do that, if I take this thing and isolate it, I end up with something pretty cute. I have nothing is under sum. I have the product of the individual components, just as I had before in the fully observable case. But for the missing data case, I have the summation over all possible values of this missing variable given the class. And can anyone tell me what this is? It's 1, right? So this again is axioms of probability. When you add up probabilities over all possible values of a variable, you should get a 1, right? So this is just a 1. So effectively, you can just strike it off. So that takes us back to the original formula, right? In this product, you're essentially just striking off xj, and everything else stays the same. So why does it work? Because of the independence. If you didn't assume independence, you wouldn't be able to play this trick. Okay, so another good thing to look at when we're talking about naive Bayes. Yeah?
Can I ask something there for the last thing you showed us? Basically.
Actually, you know what? Can we do this after class? Because it's the kind of thing that can actually take a long time. Okay, so from the efficiency point of view, naive Bayes is probably as fast as it gets. As far as the learning methods. Some learning methods will be faster at testing time. So for example, decision trees, which we're going to talk about next. Once you've built a tree, applying the tree to new data is just ridiculously fast. And it probably is faster than naive Bayes. But as far as training the model, estimating things, naive Bayes is probably the fastest. It's also, well, okay. So the complexity of naive Bayes. So if n is the number of instances, whether training or testing, d is the number of dimensions, and c is the number of classes, then the computational complexity is ndc. And this is both for training and testing, which is particularly nice. Another thing, so naive Bayes is often used on highly sparse data. And for highly sparse data, there's two different Ds that you talk about. There is the total number of dimensions. Like, so say you're dealing with emails, right? The total number of dimensions is the total number of words in your vocabulary. And that could run into tens of thousands, or again, if you're taking TTS, you know about Heap's law, so you know that it's infinite, right? There's also a little d, which is how many distinct dimensions occur in any given email, how many words you have in an email. So the little d is usually a lot smaller than the big D. And for naive Bayes, it's the little d that figures in the complexity, which is really nice. I guess another thing is, because there is no iterative nature to naive Bayes, there's no hidden constants in this. When Charles talks about regression methods, the complexity for regression is similar, except that there is a hidden component that has to do with how many times you're going to iterate over changing your weights. The space complexity is also nice. It's not as nice as some other classifiers. You have to store C different models, and each model typically has D dimensions. This is actually a big D in terms of words if your data is sparse. Another nice property of naive Bayes is that when you apply classification in practice, a lot of the time you don't have all of your data at once. Sometimes you're receiving the data incrementally. So for example, if you're trying to predict the weather, you have some observations, some sensor inputs, and then sort of in the evening you get to find out what the weather actually was like today. So what you would like to do at this point is you would like to update whatever predictor you had. At the end of the day, you may get some information of which emails the users thought were spam or were not spam. So you want to update your classifier. Naive Bayes makes it really easy. So both both insertion and deletion of new instances into the classifier can be done in O of D, where D is the dimensionality of the data. And again, almost no hidden constants. So how do you do this? And the trick to doing it, there's nothing major here. This is just, all you have to do is, instead of storing probabilities in that table, you store the raw counts, right? So if you think back to our, naive Bayes example, here I was storing essentially probabilities, right? So I'm storing one half for half. Now, all I have to do is I basically just have to store one, and then somewhere separately I have to store a two, which is the total number of ham emails. And then when I get a new example of class C, all I have to do is I just have to update for each dimension. I have to update the counts, how many times I saw that word mentioned for this particular class, and also increment the total number of instances of that class and the total number of instances in the data, because I'm going to need that for the prior, right? And then when I need to classify, it's trivial to recompute the probability itself. You just take the n of cd and divide by n of c, and for the prior, you have n of c over the total number of training instances, right? So trivial. And, you know, to avoid zero frequencies, you add the epsilons here and there. So it's really easy to update. If you're deleting an example, it's equally easy. You just subtract the counts from this example from the overall counts. You can play the same trick with continuous data. So this was for categorical attributes for Bernoulli. This was for sparse data where we're using Bernoulli. If you have continuous space, all you have to do is, instead of storing the mean and the variance, you store the partial sums, right? So if you store the partial sum of all the values and the sum of squares of all the values, then you can update them quite quite easily, right? When a new item comes in, you just add the counts, and then on the fly, you can recompute the mean, which is just the sum divided by the total, and the variance, which is sort of the second moment minus the square of the mean. That's just the definition of the variance. So this is nice because it means you can have a fully streaming, fully online system that adapts and really doesn't have to retrain. Most of the other classifiers we'll discuss, they require retraining. If you have new data, you don't always have to retrain from scratch, but you do have to retrain. With naive Bayes, the updates are trivial. Right. So in terms of the overall structure, we'll try to do this for many of the classifiers that we do. Naive Bayes, it's primarily used for classification. You could imagine doing it for regression, but that's a little weird. So the class structure is you're trying to classify something into k classes. The way the model looks is you have k individual models, one for each class. The dimensionality of the model is typically d, so that's a number of probabilities. If you're counting words, or the mean and the variance, if you're doing numbers, so the distributions are typically Gaussian if you're working in the continuous space with real-valued attributes, or the Bernoulli if you're counting things like words. The score function is likelihood, so this probability of the observation given a class. Another name for it is likelihood. There is actually no optimization or search procedure involved. We are just storing counts, so that the solution to naive Bayes is analytic. You just compute the means and the variances directly. All right. I guess as a summary, so we talked about naive Bayes. I looked at the one continuous example and one discrete example of how it works. We talked about the drawbacks. The drawbacks is it cannot handle correlated data, so remember this and this, right? And in the discrete example, it is fooled by repetition, so if you stuff NeMo with hammy words, you will likely fool the classifier. You must also deal with zero frequency, even though that's not much of a drawback. I mean, this is just something that you have to keep in mind. on the positive sides, it's a very simple classifier. It explicitly includes prior information, which many other classifiers don't. It has a very simple way of handling missing data, right? You just ignore it, and it's sort of formally grounded. And it's nice from the complexity standpoint and in the sense that you can update it quite simply. Okay, so in the next lecture, we're going to talk about decision trees. If you haven't registered for tutorials, please do it. Marginalizing out. You are saying so. The reason that missing data is a problem is you can't compute the layout.
Yes.
And here, what you're saying, I want to compute the layout. So I'm going to assume that missing data means either this.
Yes, but I believe that. But shouldn't you multiply the digits? For example, if it is head, multiply with the possibility that it will, you will get head. For example, the.
You do.
But if you sum this, you don't get one.
Yes.
ไม่มันบวกเข้าไปหนึ่ง
ไม่มันบวกอีกสองบวกแต่ว่ามันถ้า